got so many attacking flair players. You want to see end to end, almost a bit like the Gaelic you watch. It's not really like that, you know.
You've got to score because you know that they're going to.
For the best Euro 2020 coverage, subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast and download the OTB Sports app.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetsetGo. Quick start car insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at GetsetGo.ie.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Donating at least 100,000 to Irish football via England Goals this summer. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
I'm prepared to anything I can
well,
to
do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
You're welcome along to the football show. I take it the withdrawal symptoms are taking hold at this stage. No football today. A rest day. And another rest day tomorrow, I'm sorry to say. 48 hours of absolute torment for many of you. To keep you going, we've got a great football show coming your way this evening. And then tomorrow on Off the Ball, Seamus Coleman, the Irish captain, will be speaking with Jerron Owen on OTB AM. And then tomorrow evening, Stephen Kenny will be on with Nathan. So that's on the way tomorrow. This evening, though, the main event, as far as I'm concerned, Damien Delaney, hello to you.
Hey, Joe, how are you?
What's happening?
Nothing really, man. As you said, just taking a moment to catch our breaths before it really kicks into high-octane stuff at the weekend.
I mean, can it get more high-octane? Just to give a sense of the last few days, I was just jotting this down to almost get it straight in my head because the days blend into one at the moment. I only remember them really by virtue of what football was on that day. So on Saturday, we had the Danes coming out and spanking the Welsh 4-0. We had Italy taken to extra time by the Austrians. And then on Sunday, the Dutch crash out. Your old friend, Frank de Boer, having a difficult afternoon. Belgium-Portugal, second half there was enthralling in its own grim sort of way, even though there were no actual goals scored. And then things went off another level on Monday. Bonkers. Spain 5, Croatia 3, the French against the Swiss 3-3, and then penalties. That's just the 14 goals in two games for you there, Damien. And then yesterday we had those scenes at Wembley, England 2, Germany 0. So it's been good stuff, I think.
Yeah, I think it's been great, to be honest. I think I was talking to lads on the show on Monday morning, and I was saying that, you know, the group stages for me are just kind of, you want to get them over and done with so you can get into the real stuff, you know, and we're at it now. We really are. It's knockout stuff, and everyone seems to be bringing their A games, and there's mistakes are being made, and they're hugely costly, and it's thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyable, and it's only going to get better between here and the final.
So here's your calendar. Friday, 5 o'clock, it's Spain against not the French, but the Swiss. So that's at 5 on Friday, Switzerland against Spain, to be followed by 8 o'clock, Belgium against Italy, Friday at 8, and then on Saturday, 5 o'clock, Czech Republic against Denmark, and then 8 o'clock in Rome, Ukraine against England, and we have rest days again until semi-finals on Tuesday and Wednesday. So Belgium, Italy certainly catches the eye, and I suppose we're all interested in England, whether we want to admit it or not, against Ukraine, 8 o'clock in Rome, their first match away from Wembley, which is something. You did feel like Wembley was a major advantage yesterday and has been throughout.
Yeah, it has been. You contrast to the Welsh and the problems they had to go through, the fact that they're allowed to have supporters there, they're so used to it. There's obviously players there who played for Tottenham and it was their home ground for a number of years. So there's certainly a familiarity with it. You know, they're probably based up in St George's Park there and then come down and maybe stay at the Grove the night before the game. I think that's what they do. So there's a familiarity, a comfort, a routine that they're all used to. Fans coming back in the stadium, it's all lined up brilliantly for them. I know they've got a big test to go and beat Ukraine, who are no mugs, despite what some people say when they look at them. They're a pretty difficult side to beat. You know, there's nothing special about them, but they just seem to have a way or a style or a belief or something about them that's gotten them this far, and there'll be no pushover for England, especially in Rome.
Because I saw Damien Duff saying he was absolutely certain England would beat them.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of alluding to. On paper, yes, and I see where he's coming from. They shouldn't cause England any problems. They're the type of teams that if this was a Nations League game, I'd agree with him. But they've got this far, and I think I'm right in saying they topped their group as well with Portugal in it. So I'm not sure that I agree with that statement in its entirety, because on paper, yes, but wow, I tell you what, this team just have a way of grinding and digging out, and they don't look the prettiest, and they can just drag the game into the gutter. And if England think they're going to go there and waltz out of Rome with a win into a semi-final, I think they got another thing coming. I think they're going to have a real test on their hands, and luckily, listening to Gareth Southgate, luckily for England, that he seems to have a handle on that and what he's saying, that it's not going to be any cakewalk. So complacency, really, now is England's only enemy to the final.
Because England have been pretty pragmatic. They're not free-flowing. They're not creating a bunch of chances. They're about keeping things tight at the back. So they're playing almost a lesser version of themselves in Ukraine. And that could get frustrating, especially if they hit 60, 70, 80 minutes and there's no breakthrough.
It could do. But I mean, you know, you and me had a discussion the last number of weeks about has Southgate kind of plotted his way, and has he got a team for every game they're going to play? You know, he left the three number 10s on the bench against Germany. I mean, when I saw the team come in, I was thinking, Lord, if he loses this, he'll never be allowed to set foot in England again, because all that kind of attacking, or the array of talent that they had, to go and put the team out that he put out, I mean, was gutsy. He obviously had a plan, a thought process behind it. I tell you, if he lost that game, I mean, he would have been absolutely run out of England, never be allowed back in again.
I'm really glad you framed it that way. Because looking at the general reaction before kickoff when the team was named, words like conservative and cowardice were used, and he's afraid, all of these interpretations of the team. And I totally agreed with you. I thought, a bit like the Trippier decision against Croatia, this was an unbelievably brave decision on Southgate's part to go with this team, because he knew full well, and it applied to Trippier the first day out as well, which was a very pressurised game in its own way, that the omissions of Grealish, Foden, Mount, as you say, they would be seized upon. I mean, it would be the easiest Monday morning quarterbacking session of all time for everybody, you know, and it would be very convincing as well. And Southgate would genuinely look, one, incredibly negative, and two, like a bit of a fool. And I don't know, did you see on ITV, I know the match was on BBC, but I was just on ITV's social media channels. He was interviewed by Gabriel Clark, and he said to Clark, and this was about 4 minutes into maybe a 5-6 minute interview, and he didn't make a big deal out of saying it. He didn't say it in very hushed tones or really kind of stare down the camera when he said it. It was more just of an aside. And he said, if I picked that team and that system and we didn't win today, I'm dead. He said, I'm dead. Oh. I'm dead, is what he said. So in his own way, he knew that this was so risky. It was the opposite of cowardice. I thought it was somebody sticking to their guns brilliantly and saying, I know what I think is right here, and even though the PR of this could be horrific for me, I have to do what I think is right. That was very brave.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think his obituary was being written, I think, by a lot of people at half time. I think there was probably the press in England were writing it, absolutely. But he stuck to his beliefs, whether anyone knew. I'd love to know, maybe in time we will find out what his thought process was. You know, if England go on and win it, I'm pretty sure there'll be a few commemorative DVDs where everybody sits down.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so. You know, every minute of the tournament will be scrutinised and explained by the manager. So maybe one day we might actually get to see what his thought process was. But it was gutsy, because he must have known that if I get this wrong or Germany get the nose in front, I have to bring these three number 10s off the bench. And maybe that was his line of thinking. But I think to put myself in his shoes and to give maybe some sort of insight into what he was thinking, maybe he felt that Germany weren't the force that they were, and they were a team that potentially capitalized on mistakes. When they got the nose in front, they were quite difficult to peg back. But I suppose if he just sparred with them for long enough, he felt that they had holes that could be poked in them. And obviously, you know, you could get the three number 10s on the pitch when they've maybe punched themselves out to an extent. But he probably didn't feel like that. If he goes there and he takes the game to Germany and he kind of says, no, we're England. Germany aren't in a good place. We're going to go all out attack here. They could catch them, you know, with a kind of a rabbit punch or something. And maybe once they get their nose in front, panic could ensue and the Germans might go. So he probably just thought, you know what, I'm just going to spar with them and throw a couple of jabs here and there. And then when we get to 60 minutes, we'll reevaluate. And I really feel that once the game is kind of settled, I can get Grealish on the pitch. And I'm pretty sure, well, not pretty sure, but I think that's probably how he drew it up in his head.
And so it worked out perfectly. And so afterwards, he's vindicated. And as you said, he had the courage of his convictions. Did you think it was the right plan, though? I mean, you're saying you knew that he'd be in trouble, and you could also see his logic. But that's not to say you agreed with his logic and thought it was the best way to approach the game in advance. What did you think in advance?
In advance, I thought that he would stick his chest up and puff his chest out and just swagger onto Wembley and really just apply pressure on the Germans and go and beat them. But he's been pragmatic in the extreme in this tournament. Yeah. And I mean, really, really in the extreme. With the, you look at the teams he's picked, the formations.
Yeah.
He's not really done that in to my memory, I'm open to correction here, but in the Nations League and in qualifiers, it has been a certain swagger about England, I think, in a lot of their games. Mm-hmm.
Did you think when you saw that 3-4-3, you said to yourself, I know what he's doing here, did you agree or disagree?
I didn't think anything. I thought I was going to let it play out before I made my decision because it was too difficult to call. I remember thinking, oh, that's gutsy. I mean,
okay. You didn't think to yourself, oh, no, this is wrong. You thought, okay, I see what he's doing here and let's see.
I half thought this is what he's doing insofar as he just doesn't want to antagonize the Germans or give them anything. But I just thought, oh, if he gets beat, I mean, it is the worst kind of defeat. I mean, at least if he goes, attacks the Germans and he loses, he can come out and say, well, we went out in our sword. But my God, it was probably the riskiest of risky plays in terms of the outcome that could have been. Mm. Listen, fair play to him. I mean, really, really gutsy call. If I'm correct in what I'm saying, that's the only an observation that I can give, really. And I think it's probably not a million miles away from the truth, you know.
Oh, no, you're definitely right. I mean, when he leaves that Grealish, Foden, Mount, it's fairly self-explanatory. Yeah. And so when you match up the Germans like that, that's predicated on winning those individual battles then. So clearly he backed Trippier to take care of Gosens. He obviously thought Shaw would do okay against Kimmich. And then he must have felt that Phillips and Rice had the measure of the German midfield. I don't know, would he have anticipated Goretzka playing with Kroos? Maybe he would have thought it was Gundogan. But either way, he must have said to himself, whatever about the craft of someone like Kroos, and be it Gundogan or Goretzka, he must have said, I'm backing the energy of Phillips and Rice there.
Yeah, I think so. But I think it was certainly kind of more built around strength in numbers, because he had seven defenders. I mean, seven and then three attackers. That's the way he went. And I think he basically just went strength in numbers, that if my midfield players get beat, I've got a back three. So if one of my centre backs get beat, I've got another two. You know, my fullbacks weren't exactly rip-roaring forward and joining in attacks. They joined in when, but I mean, ultimately it was seven defenders.
Okay.
And they just kind of hung in there, but kind of stifled the game and thought, you know what, Harry Kane's going to get a chance, Raheem Sterling's going to get a chance. And if they don't take one of those chances, then I can bring the big guns on after 60 minutes or reevaluate it, you know.
It was kind of surprising then the way Germany cut through them a few times. The Rice foul and Goretzka early on, and then the Werner chance could have totally transformed the complexion of the game, because the other thing about Southgate's plan was, it's really not a plan that would have dealt well with going 1-0 down early.
No, but I don't think, not early, no, but I still think that he had ammunition on the bench, that if he did go 1-0 down and it was 1-0 going into 60 minutes, he was probably prepared to swallow that, so to speak, and then maybe get the big hitters on. But, I mean, it was so, so risky. I mean, the Muller one even. I mean, the Muller chance is it. But this is what we're talking about. It's so finely balanced. And the margins are wafer thin, you know, when you get to this level of football. And this is the beauty about getting knockout football, tournament football, where it's all at stake. And it can switch on a dime, really can. Yeah. And that's where we're at. And unfortunately, managers get paid to make these decisions, split-second decisions. And when they're wrong, they're wrong. There's no coming back. It's not like a league game where you can go, okay, we're playing again Tuesday night or whatever. And, you know, that's the kind of the level we're at. And that's why these managers get paid so much money, because the good ones, you know, the managers can get those decisions right on the spot, really, are the ones that are really sought after.
Where are you and Harry Kane at the moment then?
I'm really positive for him. With the pragmatic approach they've had, I mean, he's going to be limited. You know, he's going to be stifled. That's probably the wrong word, but he's definitely going to be hindered, I suppose, with especially with the team that he picked the other night. I mean, what kind of service is he getting? What kind of space is he getting? You know, when nobody's getting up to help him, sometimes the balls he's getting, because when you play seven at the back and you get deep, the ball out up to him isn't a quality, not all the time. It's not always going to be a quality ball. It's going to be up around his neck. It's probably going to be on the side of the defender where Harry Kane knows I'm going to get absolutely battered here, but I have to go for it. The centre-back's going to come through me, but I need to do my best. Sometimes he's probably competing for headers thinking, I'm not going to win this, but I need to make sure the centre-back doesn't head it 40 yards down on top of my back four again, so I just need to jump into him and make life difficult for him. So he's essentially just sacrificing himself up there in the hope that that chance comes along, and it did in the end. So, look, you know, the team isn't set up for him to be top scorer in the tournament, unfortunately, when you look at the way England have gone about it. But he's off the mark now. With the approach moving forward, does he stay the same, Joe? Does he, you know... Ukraine and possibly Denmark and just keep this pragmatic approach all the way to the final and then do the same to Italy? I'm not sure. I can't see him kind of taking the shackles off the minute now and going for it. So it looks like this is the way they're going.
If you're not taking the shackles off against Scotland, you're probably not going to do it now in the knockout stages. So on Kane then, it's not so much that you think he's in really dreadful form. I think we can all agree he's not at his absolute best and sharpest, and there was that chance that fell at his left foot and he took a touch inside and didn't quite happen for him. But it's not that he's on the floor the way people are talking about it. Like, Shearer pretty much went for him, I think. First game against Croatia, said way too slow, doesn't look right, looked leggy. And to be fair, he probably did, you know, there's something in that. But even last night, or yesterday, at halftime, Shearer did a piece like looking down at the pitch, aerial view, and shown Harry Kane's lack of movement. Now, what frustrated me as a viewer is it was just one passage of play. Like, I think if you're going to hammer someone like that as a pundit, you're duty bound to show five or six or seven examples of when he could have moved and didn't, because then it's a trend, whereas anything could be happening in a single moment. So I thought that I never liked that when it's a one-off moment. Yeah. But like, Shearer's point was really, he's not really doing enough here. He's not moving enough, which seemed like a vague enough kind of...
That's so wrong. I mean, that's wrong on so many levels. I mean, he's up the pitch as a number nine. When he's not having movement, he's got wingers alongside him. That's why Sterling and Saka play, because they're the ones that run in behind. Sometimes they're just saying to him, stay high, stay central, and occupy the two centre-backs possibly. But like, Harry Kane's never been the most mobile or, you know, fantastically amazing kind of all-action number nine. It's not his nature. He needs bodies around him. He needs runners. He needs people that will come in and occupy the centre-back. Just think what Son does for him at Tottenham in terms of his forward running. He needs bodies around him. He needs chaos almost, but he's up there on his own, and he's not the most mobile of guys. I mean, he can move. He's not immobile, but he's not like Diego Costa, where he can, you know, just occupy a back four on his own. You know, he's a very, very good centre-forward. But when he's up there on his own, life can be very, very difficult for lots of centre-forwards. The type of centre-forwards like Luis Suarez that can play up front in the number nine on their own and be okay. I mean, they're extremely, extremely rare to find those guys. Harry Kane needs help. He needs support. He needs service. We haven't even spoken about service. I mean, he just needs runners and balls into him. And he needs a number of chances, like most number nines do. You know, number nines that can just take one. And the fact that, you know, you pick out one chance that he missed or whatever, it's like that was his only opportunity in the game. You know, if he had two or three or four or five or six of those and he wasn't taking those chances, I'd say, yeah, he's not quite right. But Jesus, you know, every centre-forward needs help, and he's definitely that type of centre forward. So I'm not in the least bit worried. He's performing his role for the team. Yeah. You know, how many times before have you seen centre forwards that have been asked to play this role and they throw the toys out the pram and there's carnage and they're not happy because, you know, their marketability isn't going through the roof because they're not the main men anymore? But he's dutifully performing his role, and I think he's doing great, and he's got his goal now, so that's him happy.
Okay. Because even Jermaine Genius, I don't know, did you watch it on The Beeb or not, at one point in the first half, was saying, yeah, he needs to work much harder. And I was thinking, it doesn't seem like in Harry Kane's personality to not be working hard against Germany in the knockout stages of the European Championships.
That's not him, but he's not that all. Because when you play with seven defenders and you're up there on your own, you need to do it all. And that's not what he's used to. Harry Kane, especially his best times really, was under Pochettino, where he had like three number 10s, Dele Alli and in front of him, and Son running off him, and you know, two midfield players, and Trippier and Walker and Danny Rose bombing up outside him. So there was all sorts of carnage created for him, and then he just filled in his role, and he's a fantastic player. But he's not Costa and he's not Suarez, so to judge him for that is a touch unfair.
A touch unfair. But at the same time, we're not saying he's in the form of his life, I guess.
No, absolutely not. I mean, no, but I mean, I don't think he's been given the stage or the platform to be in that way.
Okay. So how now are we putting England into context in this tournament? Because I was listening to some talk start this morning radio, and I mean, the England Sense of Destiny train has left the station, Damien. I mean,
absolutely,
it's on. It's on, it's on, it's on, and they are expectant, to say the least. So, yeah. Belgium, Italy, Friday, that's one of those two gone, which is very helpful. Yeah. Spain against Switzerland, curious for your thoughts on Spain. And then, I presume, and who knows, predictions will make fools of us all, especially at the moment in this competition, but I presume it's England against Denmark. So say for a second, if we start assuming things, say it's in the next round in the semi-finals, Spain against Italy, and then England against Denmark. Only one of Spain or Italy can come through. So if you're English now and you're feeling confident, you're thinking, can we beat Italy in a final? Would that be how you see this thing going?
No, I don't. The lads asked me, on Monday, Shane and the lads, and my prediction was England will beat Germany. And I think they'll lose to Denmark in the semi-final. I mean, that's just going to be the English way. I genuinely think that, you know, England will come up against a team similar to themselves, and Denmark are probably a touch more pragmatic than what England are, and they're used to that. So if you're asking for hypotheticals and predictions, I think that the tournament is Italy's to lose. I think they'll almost certainly get to the final, and I think whoever they come up against in the final is going to find life very, very difficult. But I think England will probably scrape through against Ukraine, and the It's Coming Home balloon will be fully inflated, and they'll come up against Denmark and probably lose 1-0 or lose on penalties, and all will be well again.
Friday night, Italy against Belgium. So we're still awaiting word on Kevin De Bruyne and Eden Hazard. Belgium looked wrecked in that second half against Portugal.
Yeah,
they were just blowing, which was strange. So you suspect their team now, I mean, stripped of those two, it'll be the back three, Alderweireld, Vermaelen, Vertonghen, Meunier and Thor Hazard, Witsel and Tielemans, and then Lukaku. Without Hazard and without De Bruyne either side of them, they're a far less scary prospect. What about Italy? Did you come away from the Austrian game thinking, oh, there's some vulnerabilities there I didn't quite like? Or in some ways, did they grow in stature coming through a sticky game like that?
Absolutely. I've been saying throughout this tournament, teams like the Dutch, the Germans, that weren't in a good place coming in, that as soon as you get up against a team that kind of really tests you, if you're not in a good place, you get found out. And that's what happened to the Dutch. That's what happened to the Germans. But Italy are in a fantastic place. And they got asked some questions and they came up with the answers. It took them till extra time, but they're kind of at the stage now where it doesn't matter. I mean, when they went behind, I thought, oh, this is going to really, really show where Italy are now. But the top, top teams always find a way of winning, no matter how difficult it is or what's kind of formations or score lines they come up against, they always find a way to dig it out. And I think that Italy have been tested, and the confidence they'll draw from coming through that test will be fantastic. I agree. I think they'll beat Belgium, minus the two star players. I think Belgium are nowhere near as worrisome as what they would be. I don't think Hazard's going to make it. Looking at the way he went with his hamstring, that's not a 2 or 3 day thing. That's minimum 10 days, even if he's just kind of ruffling some fibres or whatnot. When a player is running and, you know, he grabs his hamstring as quickly as that, he's done something. Like, something has happened in his hamstring, and that is minimum 2 or 3 weeks. So I know I'm not a qualified physio, but in my experience, you know, the ones where guys are kind of, you know, complaining about the hamstring for 5-10 minutes, but they're getting on with it, and then eventually the manager goes, you know what, I'm not going to take a risk, I'm going to get him off. And he kind of walks off to the pitch, kind of going, I'm feeling something, I'm not sure, could be cramp or, you know, whatever, you know, then he might have a chance. But the way Hazard grabbed it, I think he's done. De Bruyne with the ankle injury, with the way it turned in, hey, listen, it all depends on swelling. I am an expert in ankles because I've had so many of them in my career. I do know exactly what that injury is like. I've had about 6 of them. So it just massively depends on swelling. If that thing balloons up, then he's got no chance, because you won't get the swelling out in a few days and you won't be able to play. If the swelling isn't too bad, and they can kind of get it down to an extent, you can strap an ankle. I have done that in the past as well, where you can kind of, I won't say replace ligaments with strappings. There's probably physios out there now screaming at the radio going, what is he on about? But, you know,
you're limping around now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I have torn ligaments, and I have kind of a stirrup strap on the bottom of it to just kind of lock it in place.
Yeah.
You can get through with that. You really can. You know, you won't be the most freedom of movement, but you can get through with that. So De Bruyne, I'd be potentially optimistic, but again, it just massively depends on how much swelling came into his ankle that night and the day after and how quickly they can get it out. But I'd say Hazard's done.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised De Bruyne didn't have his feet up in the air with an ice pack on it, actually.
Which again, maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe, you know.
Or else they were like, dude, it's a 3-week job. You've done a ligament. Don't worry about it.
Absolutely.
It's one or the other almost, isn't it?
Yeah, you've a complete rupture there. So you're done for at least 8 weeks. Yeah.
Well, that's on Friday night. That should be a good game. We're going to take a short break. I mean, I got to talk to you about the French game the other evening, which was just bonkers in so many ways. Football on Off the Ball with Paddy Power, Save Our Game, donating at least 100,000 or 10,000 to Irish football via England goals this summer. Yesterday's goals for Raheem Sterling and Harry Kane bring the total to 40,000 so far for Irish football. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. We're back with Jamie Delaney in 1 second. We're talking France-Switzerland from last night. The night before, my God, I'm confused, and the days, they're all blending into one. We're talking France-Switzerland from Monday night in just a second.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals total 40,000 so far for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now you're welcome back to the Football Show. Damon Delaney is with us. So let's talk France, Switzerland then from the other evening, because it was just insane. They're an odd team. Been saying it last night and the night before. They're a really odd team, France, because they have more than enough talent to win this competition. So what was your read on, let's do this in two parts, because in the middle there's 25 minutes of glorious football where they scored 3 goals almost at will. So part one is them really not doing a good job up until the penalty save in the 54th minute, and Deschamps has been criticised for his team selection as well. What was going on there with France that first 54 minutes?
I've no idea. Again, I mean, the results were decent coming into it. I thought they were in a good place. They all looked very, very good. But obviously, there will be something. I just can't quite put my finger on it. If you just fast forward to the penalty miss, maybe something that might give us a bit of an insight was Mbappe just walked off the pitch after he missed the penalty. I think, with the exception of Deschamps that stretched out an arm just to kind of give him an unlucky. I mean, normally you see when players miss penalties, the whole team will go up to him, you know, and embrace him and say, hey, look, don't worry. You know, you put yourself forward, unlucky. You know, don't worry about it. None of them did from the camera angle we saw. I mean, that must have been the loneliest walk. I mean, you think getting the walk after a red card is bad. But after missing a penalty, it's a long way to go from the penalty spot to the halfway line and down the dugout. And the pace he was walking at, it must have took about a minute. And I think with the exception of Lloris, might have patted him on the head, I think. I saw an arm come out, but none of them did. And I just think maybe that's an insight into where they're at, that they didn't have any empathy for him, or they didn't have any feeling to go and hug him and stuff like that. Now, maybe he's not a liked member of the squad. I don't know. I'm throwing that out there. I'm not sure. But I thought that was very, very strange. And I felt really, really uncomfortable watching that. So I think someone please just go and put an arm around him and just tell him it's okay. Don't worry. You know, at least you had the guts to take the penalty. You know, don't worry about it. Maybe they did so afterwards, but there was no public display. So maybe that is a slight insight into where the French were at, and that there was divisions in the squad.
Yeah, it was very striking, very unusual. Generally, the penalty taker is embraced afterwards. So it means, one, potentially they're just so distraught that they've lost this that they can't even be bothered to console each other right now. It's bigger than that. This is just such a screw-up, and they're all in their own world for that moment. Even so, though, you tend to see some consolation
Absolutely.
Of sorts.
Ah, come on, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm throwing out the potentials here. So, one, they're in their own world of pain. I don't quite buy that either. Two,
no, not at all, Joe. That's tough. So.
Two, you've picked the most likely option. Two, he's not a liked member of the squad, and that would be the first indication of that. There was the stuff pre-tournament with Giroud when he wanted to go back at him and have his own press conference, and Deschamps said, you're not doing that. So maybe there's an arrogance of sort creeping in there, or a I'm the main man attitude. Now, I don't know. Like, this is so into speculation,
Absolutely.
But that's two option. Or three, there's divisions all over the place, maybe, and it's actually a very unhappy squad. But again, they weren't an unhappy squad a couple of years ago. I'm not sure why they would be now necessarily. It's
maybe
not like
the level of success that they've had since 2018. Maybe some of them had a kind of a feeling of we deserve this. We're a great team, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ego start coming into play. Then you throw Benzema into that mix. No, I know that his comment about Giroud being a go-kart and he being an F1 car. I mean, I didn't hear that interview, so you don't know the context in what he said that. That could have been like a throwaway joke at the end to a reporter. And, you know, so I'd be very slow to, unless I actually saw the context. If he's sitting there in a serious interview and he says that and he really means it, but, you know, his face is dead serious, then I think, okay, that's not very nice. Because Giroud seems like a... Well, he is an absolute team player. I mean, he really does. He's the type of guy that sacrifices himself for everybody. I could imagine him being a really good trainer, a good leader, a good character to have around the place. And then he had the falling out with Mbappe that somehow became public. And Mbappe is kind of giving interviews saying, I wish he came and said it to me. And all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, did that start something really, you know, start a few divisions in the group? But the way he walked off was I was upset for the guy. I was thinking, I don't care. Even if I don't, you know, if I don't get on with a teammate, I'd still go and say, hey, listen, nobody deserves that. I mean, you have to have some level of feeling towards the guy, and you would go and say that to him. So I think that's really telling, personally. I really do.
Right.
And if they're not
I hadn't read as much into it, actually, as you, but I guess you've got your kind of finger on the pulse of a team. That really jumped out to you. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I do, because I just think that, like, it kind of shows where they're at. If you don't, like, when all the good teams you play in, you want to do well for yourself, but you also want to do well for your teammates. You don't want to let them down, and you do have that kind of connection to your teammates that you just have, and you don't want to let someone down. So if you miss a tackle, you get up and you run as hard as you can because you don't want to, you know, let your team down. And when someone misses a penalty, even though you know you're out, I know your first reasoning there of, like, maybe they're all lost in their own world. No, I mean, surely when a penalty is missed, you do accept it straight away and you go, okay, let's go and help the guy that scored it. I mean, if he'd have scored the penalty, if that was the winning penalty, would they all have run and celebrate with him? Of course they would have. So surely somebody should have walked down to him. I think that was very, very telling in my personal opinion.
Because the football they played from the 54th minute to the 75th minute then was different level.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. And I mean, you know, Lloris with that penalty save just seemed to spark them. It just seemed something to happen. But again, I've been saying since the start of the tournament, if your cohesive unit isn't in a good place going into a tournament, you'll get by when you're playing a certain caliber of teams because your talent will come through. But when you start getting to knockout football and you get used to teams, now you can say the Swiss are what they are, but they made it to the same stage as the French, so they have something. You know, if the Swiss didn't have something, they wouldn't have got out of the groups. They would have been like North Macedonia, or they wouldn't have got to the tournament. That team has something. Ukraine has something. You don't top a group with Portugal and then make it to this stage and score a goal in the 120th minute, I think it was, unless you have something. So these teams have something, and they won't lie down. So basically, when France throw the kitchen sink at Switzerland and they're still coming back at you, like when that went to 3-1, if you're Switzerland, you just kind of throw the towel in and say, ah, well, you know, the world champions have gone 3-1 up against us. We've had a good run. You know, we're going to get a hero's welcome when we go home. Life is great. And you just kind of accept it. But when you have a togetherness and a cohesive unit that they have, they just kind of got back up from the dead and got themselves back in the game. And France then couldn't counter that. And I think it was just sheer will. Switzerland's will was greater than the French, and that again comes back to where you are as a team and a group and a squad and the management. Have you got the grit that they had to win the World Cup? Because when the questions are asked, like Italy, you have to come up with the answers, and I think the French obviously didn't, and that's because I think the togetherness, the unit, the belief wasn't quite there.
Yeah, it's still just a very confusing situation, because even I was making the point to Mark Lawrenson yesterday, often when a team starts badly, it's generally agreed one of the more difficult things to do is to turn it on when you've got off to a bad start, to somehow come together at the right moment together and in a unified way to turn the tide. And France did that, you know, an abysmal first 50 odd minutes, and then followed by a glorious, 15. And when Pogba scores the third, go on.
Just that 15 minutes didn't come because the French said, hang on a minute, we're losing here. We're going to turn the tide. And they built up a wall of pressure, pinned them in, and really got going. A save and then a goal quickly. And all of a sudden, there was like a shot of adrenaline into the team, and they got themselves in front. But as soon as that adrenaline wore off when they were 3-1 up, they went back to being really, really poor again. So
That's the strange thing, though. So, okay, whether it's adrenaline after the penalty save and then just their talent. I mean, the two goals.
Yeah.
It's just sheer talent. And actually, Pogba is talent personified. Yeah. But what's really odd there is this French team have won a World Cup by being pragmatic, professional, seeing games out, doing just enough. So that's why I think all of us thought a 2-1, let alone 3-1. Okay, well, fair enough if they're not the team that seem to like to go on and score a fourth and a fifth, even though they could. But generally, at this stage, they've proven themselves as a team who can defend a 1 or 2 goal lead pretty easily. And that's where I'm just scratching my head. Like, I sort of get not starting well and the Swiss doing well. I absolutely get they had the talent, France, to then score 3. What I just can't get is not seeing the thing out for another 15 minutes. And it was interesting, even one of the Swiss players said he sensed an arrogance off France when they scored the 3rd goal. I don't know if Pogba's celebration tied into that or not. Like, Pogba's celebration sort of spoke of match over. But, like, the match was over as well. I just, that's where I'm scratching my head with this team. If they hadn't won a World Cup a couple of years ago, I would say there's a soft underbelly there in some way and it got exposed. But actually, they've come through really tough moments before and they have won with pragmatism and grinding games out for all the talent. That's why I'm just at a loss to explain them coughing up 2-goal lead like that. You know, it's unbelievably interesting.
But, like, you know, again, the performance wasn't great, the shot of adrenaline, and then they obviously went to 3-1. They thought, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
The Swiss are just going to roll over now, no problem. And they didn't. They went, oh my God, can you guys please just die? You know, let's get on to the next round.
Yeah.
Then the goal went in at a really bad time. And then all of a sudden, now all the issues, if there are problems, the finger pointing, the grit that I spoke about earlier isn't there to really rally and go, okay, it's only 3-2. Mm. We're still winning the game. Somebody should have said, maybe, you know, when you have your captain is in goal. I know some people have said before that they don't like goalkeepers being captain because, you know, he's not the most vocal anyway, Hugo Lloris, but somebody on the pitch should have said, hey, it's 3-2, we're still winning, okay? We haven't just gone 3-2 down, and that's what you've kind of screamed at your teammates to give some people a little bit of confidence, say, let's just batten down the hatches for 5 or 10 minutes, weather this onslaught, and we'll get out of here 3-2, and we'll move on to the next round. But it didn't come, and obviously they just kind of 3-2, and then it just, the cracks that were there just became into cavernous holes, really, and they got caught, and they deservedly got caught.
Mm. Interesting to see how they pitch up in Qatar. Deschamps is staying on, it seems. The French FA are big fans of Deschamps and he wants to stay on, so he will get an 18-month reprieve. And I guess if he wins the World Cup, then all is well and this is just a blip. Mm. It's hard to know if they're stagnating or if something's gone awry there.
You'll see in the next round of international games, I don't know, September possibly, what the problems were, because he will not take this lying down. So if he views this as in, like, that was a one-off game, that was so out of character, I can't believe that happened, but you know what, I love my squad, I'm going to stick with them and give them another go, because, you know, that was just, you know, lightning strikes, it shouldn't have happened, but it did. But if he cleans house, and certain names are banished now, and certain names, for instance, say Benzema is not invited back into the squad, or if the issues between Giroud and Mbappe are as big as what they're going to say, then maybe Giroud might not be in the squad again, because nobody wants that kind of tension. So I'm thinking the next squad that he names and the next team that he names will, and look out for it, because I think it will tell you massively what he thought went wrong against Switzerland. Because with the World Cup coming up, he will not go into it if there's any question marks.
Per Benzema, why are you turfing him out of the squad?
I'm not, like, you know what I mean? I think he's brilliant, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I'm just saying if, you know, a lot of people are saying that Benzema is this tough, tough character. I don't believe that, to be honest with you. I think he's a world-class player and he is a team player. You know, for years he led the line at Real Madrid and still does. You know, people always question his goal-scoring record for, you know, years ago, don't get me wrong. You know, recently he's been fantastic, but he does seem like a team player. You know, I'm just saying that Duffer was talking before the game that he does come with a huge amount of baggage. Maybe he knows something that I don't, but, you know, maybe that baggage and that kind of swagger or mentality, maybe the French, I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing ideas out there. I might be way off, you know.
No, it's fine. That's half the fun, I suppose, is speculating. Something's off, because that was just an inexplicable performance on the face of it. And what of Mbappe then? 12 shots, no goals. To be fair to him, he was involved in the 2 goals that France scored on 56 and 58 minutes. So it's not like he was a total passenger, but kind of a defining memory for me of Mbappe this tournament, as well as the penalty, is the miss after Pogba's brilliant pass. And then it's like he was limping away, just complete miscue. So there was something off with Mbappe. He didn't look dreadful, but something arrived there.
The explosiveness and the boyish enjoyment didn't seem to be there that he normally has, you know, the explosive dynamic nature that he had. It seemed very kind of stuck in the mud type football from him. I don't know, maybe he was tired. I have no idea what the future holds for him. He's obviously clearly going to, you know, fill in the shoes as best he possibly can for Messi and Ronaldo in the next number of years. Him and Haaland seem to be like the most likeliest that'll fill those shoes or attempt to fill those shoes. So he's a world-class player. I don't know. You know, I'm pretty sure he'll bounce back from this. He's obviously very, very mentally strong.
No, he'll be fine. I didn't want to deliberately just talk Pogba to you the whole time. And I was thinking as I was watching the game, I was like, oh, Paul, this is very, very good. You've given me a lot of ammunition here to tackle Damian Delaney with. This is just what I need. And then the third goal. And
yeah. I know, listen. I've always been a massive believer in my career that he gave the ball away on the halfway line. Now, I know people are going to scream at me that I'm crazy, but he gave the ball away on the halfway line. They said it 40 yards ago. They still had defenders. You know, it's not like he, you know, did what I did at Dalebone Park, you know what I mean, and rolled one in into his own net. I still think the team...
Why haven't I seen that, by the way? Can we get that up as some B-roll here, please?
Everyone's seen that. You know
I need to check that out. Here, I totally agree, by the way. I thought the ITV panel went after him. Like, absolutely. So if there's a pro column and a con column, that one thing, but it wasn't like a criminal offence. And if he's a playmaker, absolutely, he has to get on the ball. He's going to lose it. Okay, grand. Good. I thought you were going to dance in his grave here.
I love Pogba. I think he's absolutely world class if he's utilised in the correct way. So look, I think he gave as I said, he didn't give it away in a 6-yard box. He gave it away in a halfway line. They still could have defended it a little bit better than what they did.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you always see people complain about that. You know, centre forward gives the ball away in the opposition 18-yard box, and then there's a breakaway, and then the centre forward gets blamed. And you're like, well, I'll tell you what, if a team can go 80 yards and score against you after giving the ball away, then the structure of your team isn't quite right, or the discipline isn't there, or sometimes teams do brilliant things. So, he did give it away, but I wouldn't blame him completely for it.
No. And it shouldn't overshadow his contribution up until that point.
He was immense. And I think he's a world-class footballer. And I think if you can get the best out of him, I mean, he's the type of player I'd be building a team around. So, you know. Do you want to go down that rabbit hole, Joe?
No, I don't. No.
Okay,
not tonight. Certainly another time.
Yeah.
But not tonight.
Next year. We're starting all over again, and we'll, you know, keep that rolling.
Yeah. What about Spain then? So they play the Swiss. Morata got his goal. The centre defence doesn't look watertight. Busquets, Koke, Pedri looks like a tidy enough midfield three. They seem a little bit light at the back and a little bit light up front. But other than that, okay. Now, they did score five goals. So what are you thinking on Spain?
I think that I've always put them in the same boat as Germany, Netherlands. You know, not horrific, but they're not an amazing place. And they are going to come up against, I presume, Italy. Depends maybe that they can get a tough game in this round, but you know, as soon as somebody really puts it on their toes, I think they'll crumble.
Yeah.
You know, I think the five goals they came up against with Slovakia, I think it was, you know, Slovakia let them have their way with them. They just stood off them and pretty much gave Spain exactly what they wanted, and they duly obliged. So I think, you know, if they do come up against Italy in the semi-final or potentially Belgium, I think that, you know, once they come up against an immovable force, I think they will kind of really struggle, because that team is similar to the Dutch, where it just seems to be skipping by and maybe not build on matchsticks, like I said, with the Dutch, but, you know, it's not rock solid like the Italians. So I think that they will get found out in the semi-final at the very, very latest.
Okay. What did you make of Frank de Boer and the Dutch? He has now handed in his resignation. He was contracted up to the World Cup in Qatar. You obviously worked under him, Crystal Palace, briefly.
Look, I mean, again, not surprising. You know, I suppose the only thing that they might have hoped to do, what the Spanish did, and kind of come through these against these mediocre-ish teams. But again, as soon as it was stuck on their toes, they couldn't deal with it. They couldn't come up with any answers. There was huge problems for them leading into this tournament. I mean, there was carnage in Holland about whether, you know, the system he should be playing, whether the players were happy, whether his communication skills were brilliant. And his track record as a manager would suggest that he was very, very lucky to get that job. very, very lucky. I mean, he was handed the keys to a Ferrari in what Ronald Koeman left him. I mean, that was a well-oiled machine when you watched Koeman's teams in the Nations League, albeit with Virgil van Dijk. We will give him that. But ultimately, he took a team and just probably never watched or spoke to Koeman about what he was doing, and maybe just see could he keep the momentum in the training and get it to where it needed to be. He just came in and just kind of ripped it up, but he put his own stamp on it, and his own stamp had failed at Inter, Palace and Atlanta to an extent, I suppose. Mm. So, you know, I'm not surprised. I wasn't surprised. In fact, I think I said it before the tournament that they'd get obliterated by someone.
What was his biggest failing at Palace without redoing that whole conversation?
His biggest failing? I don't know. He just had this system and it wasn't very good. He wanted to play 3-4-3 and it wasn't good. In training, you could see it was like it wasn't a good system. It wasn't working. There was too many holes and it wasn't quite right. But he never, ever, ever, ever deviated from it. It was like, this is it. And I'm playing it, no matter, even pre-season. We didn't do well pre-season at all. And it was like, can we tweak this a little bit? Or, you know, and he just, I don't know. That's too long a story to go down. Maybe one day we will, Joe.
Okay. But in short, when you saw De Boer appointed, you weren't surprised that this wasn't going to work out. That didn't inspire you as, oh, this guy's got the right stuff here.
No, I think I tipped him not even to get out of the group. Yeah. That's how sure I was.
Because of him, not necessarily because the playing group.
Yeah, well, I think what he does to a group, really, you know, didn't look like the most happiest camp.
No. It's amazing, really.
Enthusiastic group.
It's amazing, really, in management how often, like, I talk to quite a few players in the show, and one of the things they really value from a manager is honesty. You know, they seem to love that when you ask them about managers they liked. Oh, he was so honest with me. I knew where I stood. And just generally not making them feel miserable seems to go about 70% of the way. And an awful lot of managers seem to mess up that first 70%.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's everybody likes honesty when they're getting told what they want to hear. I'm pretty sure a lot of people don't like honesty when they're getting told.
We're selling you. How's that for honesty?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, then the manager is getting called every name under the sun. So communication is obviously key. And there is a way to break bad news to players. If they're selling you or you're dropping you or you're training with the youth team or whatever it may be, there is a way to go about it. And I think every player deserves a certain level of respect, you know, insofar as even if you don't like somebody, you still knock on somebody's door or the manager calls you in, he sits down and tells you, hey, listen, this is the way it is. Mm. And you go, oh, fair enough. And you accept that. But I suppose his communication skills are atrocious, really. I mean, I'm genuinely atrocious.
Okay.
He's just not a good communicator. He just makes decisions and then just kind of when you question him on it, he looks at you like really surprised, like, oh, I didn't realize you had a problem. So that was it, really.
Yeah. Well, that's not a great combination. Who's your player of the tournament so far?
Ooh, player of the tournament. Good one. Raheem Sterling. I think he's been brilliant. I think it was a big call for him to be playing. A lot of pressure on him. I think that if he hasn't scored the goals here, it's probably another stick that we're going to batter Southgate with because, you know, everybody wants all the three superstars to play, but he's more than justified his place in the team and he got England up and running last night and I think he's been pretty good, to be honest. Yeah, there are quite a few others, but I think Raheem Sterling for me.
Okay, very good. Listen, we'll talk next week. Enjoy the football on Friday and Saturday. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Joe.
Cheers. Take care. Damon Delaney with us there. Football on Off the Ball with Paddy Power. Save Our Game, donating at least €100,000 to Irish football via England goals this summer. Yesterday's goals from Sterling and Kane bring the total to €40,000 so far for Irish football. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power's Save Our Game. England's goals total €40,000 so far for Irish football. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network with Get Set Go. Quick Start Car Insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at getsetgo.ie.